This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening, Santa Fe. My name is Liliana Segura, and it's a true honor to be here tonight to kick off Lannan Foundation's fall program at the LENSIC. Thank you. I have to say I'm genuinely humbled to be part of a calendar that includes such speakers as Amy Goodman, Barbara Ehrenreich, Eduardo Galeano, Omar Barghouti, and other amazing people who are coming to Santa Fe this season. And especially, I want to say, in the middle of an election season, that reminds us of the incredible wealth and resources that are poured into petty politics and pageantry that does so little for the common good. I'm just so grateful to Lannan for supporting the work of truth tellers and activists and people who are truly fighting for a better world. And of course, it's a particular thrill for me to share the stage tonight with such a remarkable woman whose scholarship and advocacy have struck a real nerve in this country and reframed and revitalized an old debate at a time when it was most desperately needed. She's a woman who has shaken people awake and made many people see for the first time this monstrous injustice that's been built up in our own backyards over the past decades. And from a publishing perspective, I have to say, she's also a woman who has turned conventional wisdom on its head. I've been told for years that prison books just don't really sell. They're great, but they just don't sell. Well, the initial print run for The New Jim Crow was, I believe, 3,000 copies. And as of March of this year, the paperback has sold more than 58 times that, to total beyond 175,000 copies. That's right. And I was just in touch with the New Press today, and they said they just, by way of an update, that the paperback has been on the New York Times bestseller list for 9 months. So, The New Jim Crow obviously has been honored with numerous prizes, including the NAACP Image Award for nonfiction, and has inspired everything from legislation to grassroots organizing. I live in New York City, where I'm proud to report that we are now home to the campaign to end The New Jim Crow, which is organizing and using the book as an organizing tool, both on the streets and in study groups. Thank you. So, let me talk about Michelle Alexander. You might know that aside from being a first-time and best-selling author, Michelle Alexander has been a longtime civil rights advocate and litigator. You might also know, and it maybe it's in the program, that she served for several years as the director of the Racial Justice Project at the ACLU of Northern California, and that after that, she taught at Stanford Law School. And you might have even heard that before doing all those things, she was a law clerk for Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun. But here's something you might not know that I didn't know until fairly recently. Michelle Alexander didn't just work for Justice Blackmun. As a Supreme Court clerk during his final term, she would prove instrumental in helping him articulate an evolving opinion on an issue that he had grappled with for decades and which ultimately would come to define his legacy. And that issue is the death penalty. By the time Michelle Alexander arrived in Washington as a clerk, Justice Blackmun had decided that he wanted to reject capital punishment once and for all, and he asked his clerks at the time to help him find the right case, the right vehicle for him to do that. Well, Michelle Alexander took the lead, and that fall, a Texas death row prisoner named Gary Graham, who was also known as Chaco Sankofa, and many believed to be innocent, was facing execution. So using his case as a vehicle, Michelle Alexander drafted a dissent, writing to Justice Blackmun, quote, "I have tried to put myself in your shoes and write a dissent that would reflect the wisdom you have gained and the frustration you have endured as a result of 20 years of enforcing the death penalty on this court." End quote. But you didn't stop there. As time passed, you repeatedly urged Justice Blackmun to make good on that vow, writing to him at one point a note that said, quote, "This morning at breakfast you mentioned that you would like to release the dissent by the end of the calendar year. I think this is wise." I thought it was wise, too. Well, in the end, Justice Blackmun not only used the dissent that she drafted, as New York Times reporter Linda Greenhouse wrote in her book, Becoming Justice Blackmun, quote, aside from some minor editing, Blackmun accepted nearly everything Alexander had written, end quote. And so it was largely through her influence that on February 22nd, 1994, he would hand down that famous dissenting line, quote, from this day forward, I no longer shall tinker with the machinery of death. I don't know where you go from there when you're in your 20s, but from there, in 1995, Michelle Alexander was the only lawyer hired by the country's best civil rights law firm when it came to employee discrimination lawsuits. And as a reporter for the St. Petersburg Times wrote in a profile of the firm in 1996, quote, Alexander not only has the credentials, she also has empathy for the people she represents. Her demeanor makes it seem as if it's okay to spill your guts about the inequities of the world. And to me, it's this description, having just read her book again, this passion and empathy that's at the heart of the new Jim Crow and her scholarship. And while Michelle Alexander has often described how the book is the result of her own journey, her own journey from not seeing to ultimately seeing this new racial caste system in our midst, it is also clearly the product of qualities that she's had all along. And I think that's what makes it such a moving and important piece of scholarship that I'm very excited she's going to be discussing here with us tonight. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Michelle Alexander.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. It is so good to be here. It is so good to be here, and thank you so much for the invitation and Liliana's very generous introduction. I'm just really thrilled to be here and to be part of this phenomenal lecture series. Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. once said that a time comes when silence itself is a betrayal. And in so many ways, this lecture series is about breaking silences that are used to obscure, deny, and exclude marginalized people, poor people, people who live on the margins of our society, and yet who we remain in silent denial about. And the silence surrounding mass incarceration is one that I am desperate to break. I have to say that really this work that I have been engaged in over the last several years has become the passion of my life, trying to find ways to break silences in communities all across this country. And I've come to wonder whether we've been silent or simply asleep. Dr. King once said there is, quote, nothing more tragic than to sleep through a revolution, end quote. And he was talking at that time about a profound moral revolution that was underway, a struggle for the recognition of the value and dignity of all humankind, a struggle to end what was then America's latest caste system known as Jim Crow. And he told his audience the story of Rip Van Winkle, who fell asleep for 20 years. When he began his extended nap, there was a sign posted on a nearby inn that had a picture of King George III emblazoned on it. When Rip Van Winkle awoke a couple decades later, the sign had a picture of George Washington on it. And Dr. King told the audience that the most striking fact about Rip was not that he had slept for 20 years, but that he had slept through a revolution. He said, quote, there are all too many people who, in some great period of social change, fail to achieve the new mental outlooks that the new situation demands. Well, I think his words are as relevant today as they were back then. Many of us, myself included, have slept through a revolution, actually a counter-revolution. It is a counter-revolution that has blown back so much of the progress that Dr. King and so many other advocates risked and ultimately gave their lives for. This revolution has occurred with barely a whimper of protest, even as millions of people, primarily poor folks of color, have been swept into our nation's prisons and jails and then relegated to a permanent second-class status in which they are stripped of the basic civil and human rights supposedly won in the civil rights movement. While many of us have been asleep, a vast new system of racial and social control has emerged, one that would certainly have Dr. King turning in his grave. I think one day we may look back and wonder how we could have possibly slept for so long. Well, tonight I've been asked to share with you the thesis of my book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. And to a large extent, the title of the book speaks for itself. I argue that today, in the so-called era of colorblindness, and yes, even in the age of Obama, something akin to a caste system is alive and well in America. The mass incarceration of poor people, especially poor folks of color, is tantamount to a new caste system, when specifically designed to address the social, political, and economic challenges of our time. It's the moral equivalent of Jim Crow. Now, I'm always eager to admit, to acknowledge, that there was a time when I rejected this kind of talk. There was a time when I rejected comparisons between mass incarceration and slavery or mass incarceration and Jim Crow, believing those kinds of claims and comparisons were exaggerations, distortions, were hyperbole. In fact, there was a time when I thought that people who were making those kinds of claims and those kinds of comparisons were actually doing more harm than good to efforts to reform our criminal justice system and achieve greater racial equality in the United States. But what a difference a decade makes. For after years of representing victims of racial profiling and police brutality and investigating patterns of drug law enforcement in poor communities of color and attempting to assist people who had been released from prison re-enter into a society that had never shown much use for them in the first place, I had a series of experiences that began what I now call my awakening. I began to awaken to a racial reality that is so obvious to me now that what seems odd in retrospect is that I managed to be blind to it for so long. As I describe in the introduction, what has changed since the collapse of Jim Crow has less to do with the basic structure of our society than the language we use to justify it. In the era of colorblindness, it is no longer socially permissible to use race explicitly as a justification for discrimination, exclusion, and social contempt. So we don't. Rather than rely on race, we use our criminal justice system to label people of color criminals and then engage in all the practices that we supposedly left behind. Today, it is perfectly legal to discriminate against criminals in nearly all the ways in which it was once legal to discriminate against African Americans. Once you're labeled a felon, the old forms of discrimination, employment discrimination, housing discrimination, denial of the right to vote, exclusion from jury service, suddenly legal. As a criminal, you have scarcely more rights and arguably less respect than a black man living in Alabama at the height of Jim Crow. We have not ended racial caste in America. We have merely redesigned it. Now, like I said, though, I reached this conclusion reluctantly. I resisted it. But there were a number of experiences that finally began to open my eyes, and one in particular I'll never forget. It involved a young African-American man who was about 19 years old, who walked into my office one day and forever changed the way I viewed not only our criminal justice system, but how I viewed myself as a civil rights lawyer and advocate. At the time, I was the director of the Racial Justice Project for the ACLU in California, and we had launched a major campaign against racial profiling by the police. We called it the DWB campaign, or the Driving While Black or Brown campaign. And we had created a hotline number for people to call who believed they had been stopped or targeted by the police on the basis of race. And we put this hotline number up on billboards and communities around California, in Oakland, San Jose, and elsewhere, urging people to call this number if they believed they had been stopped or targeted by the police on the basis of race. And in fact, within the first few minutes of us announcing this hotline number on the evening news, we received thousands of calls and our system crashed temporarily. We had to expand the capacity. And so I was spending my day interviewing one young black, brown young man after another who had been targeted, stopped, frisked, their cars had been pulled over, searched, sometimes brutalized for no apparent reason other than the color of their skin. And it was late in the afternoon, and I was getting tired. When this young man walks in with a stack of papers about this thick, he had taken detailed notes of his encounters with the police over about a 9-month period of time in his neighborhood. He had an extraordinary amount of detail. He had dates of each encounter, descriptions of each incident, names of witnesses, in some cases, badge numbers of police officers, just an unbelievable amount of documentation, detail about this pattern of police stops he had experienced in his neighborhood. And the stories of what he was describing going on in his neighborhood were corroborated by other stories we had heard coming out of his neighborhood. And I started to think, well, maybe he's the one. Maybe he's going to be our lead plaintiff in the suit we were planning to file against the Oakland Police Department, a class action suit challenging their profiling practices. And so I started asking him more questions, and I saw he was well-spoken and composed, and he was a good-looking young man, and I thought, he's the one. You know, we can put him on the television, and the media will love him. This is it. And then he said something that made me pause, and I said to him, did you just say you're a drug felon? Did you just say you're a drug felon? We had been screening people with prior criminal convictions. When people would call our hotline number, we would send a form to them to fill out, asking them a bunch of questions about their experiences with the police, and one of them was, have you ever been convicted of a felony? We believed we couldn't represent someone in a class action lawsuit challenging racial profiling if they had a criminal record, because we knew that if they did, the media and law enforcement would be all over us saying, well, of course the police should be keeping their eye on him. He's a felon. And we knew we wouldn't be able to put him on the stand in front of a jury without him being cross-examined for an hour about his prior criminal record, taking the focus off the police conduct and putting it on the prior criminal history of the man. And so we had been screening people with prior criminal records, and he had not checked the metaphorical box. So I said to him, tell me, you know, have you been convicted of a felony? And he gets quiet, and he stares down at the table for a few minutes, and then finally he just looks up, looks me right in the eye, and he says, yeah, I'm a felon, but let me tell you what happened to me. Let me tell you. The police framed me. They planted drugs on me, and they beat up me and my friend. He starts telling me this big, long story about how he'd been set up by the police, and the police had planted drugs on him and beat him up, and I said, I am sorry. I am sorry. I cannot represent you if you have a criminal record. I tried to explain to him why that was the case and why we just couldn't possibly take that kind of risk in our litigation, and it was wrong, but I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. I keep trying to explain, and he keeps trying to give me more information, more details. He says, I took the plea because I was scared of doing time. They told me I could go, you know, to prison for years, maybe even decades if I didn't take the plea. So I pled out. They said I would just get felony probation. I could walk out of there if I would just take the plea. And I said, I'm sorry, there is nothing that I can do. And then he becomes enraged. And he says to me, you're no better than the police. You're no better than the police. The minute I tell you I'm a felon, you just stop listening. You can't even hear what I have to say. It's like, what's to become of me? I can't get a job anywhere because of my felony record. I I can't get a job anywhere. It's like I can't even get access to public housing. I can't even get into public housing. I have to sleep in my grandma's basement at night because nowhere else will take me in. Says I can't even qualify for food stamps to feed myself because of my felony record. What's to become of me? He says, good luck finding one young black man in my neighborhood they haven't gotten to yet. They've gotten to us all already. And he snatches all those papers and notes off table and just starts ripping them up into tiny little pieces, throwing them in the air. Snowing white paper in my office. He turns around, walks out yelling, you're no better than the police. I can't believe I trusted you. He takes off. Well, several months after that, I'm doing a public access television show that was broadcasting live out of his neighborhood. I was doing public access TV because we were trying to organize thousands of people to attend a major protest against the then governor's refusal to sign racial profiling legislation in California. So we were doing public access TV, urging people to get on the bus and go to the demonstration at the Capitol, and it was broadcasting live. The minute the show goes off the air, he comes bursting into the studio carrying a dirty potted plant. And he comes rushing up to me, and he's emotional, practically on the verge of tears. He rushes up to me, thrusts this dirty potted plant into my arms, and he says, I'm just here to tell you I'm sorry. I'm sorry for how I treated you. So I've been seeing you on the news. I see you out there trying to fight for our people, trying to do the right thing, and I shouldn't have treated you that way. He said, I would have bought you some flowers, but I still don't have any money. I snatched this plant off my grandma's front porch. Here. Pushes my arm. And then he turns around and takes off, runs out of the building. I chase after him. He jumps into this broke-down car and takes off. Well, several months after that, I'm in my office. I open up the newspaper. What's on the front page? Well, the Oakland Writers police scandal is broken. Turns out that a gang of police officers, otherwise known as a drug task force, had been planting drugs on suspects, beating folks up in his neighborhood, and who's identified as one of the main officers charged with planting drugs on suspects and beating folks up? The officer he had identified to me as having planted drugs on him and beat up him and his friend. And it was only then that the light bulb finally started to go on for me. And I thought to myself, he's right about me. I'm no better than the police. The minute he told me he was a felon, I just stopped listening. Couldn't even hear what he had to say. And that was the beginning of me asking myself some hard questions of myself as a civil rights lawyer and advocate. How am I actually replicating the very forms of discrimination, exclusion, and marginalization I'm supposedly fighting against? And I started asking some bigger questions about the system as a whole. Started asking myself, why is it that we haven't been able to find one young black man in his neighborhood they haven't gotten to yet? What is really going on there? So I began to do an enormous amount of research. And I started asking myself and others a lot of hard questions. And I began listening more carefully to the stories of those cycling in and out of prison. And what I learned in that process truly blew my mind. But of all the things that I learned, what has stayed with me most is that my real crime was not in refusing to represent an innocent man. My real crime was in imagining that there was some path to racial justice that did not include those who we view as guilty. Here are some of the facts that I learned in the course of my work and research. More African-American adults are under correctional control today in prison or jail, on probation or parole, than were enslaved in 1850, a decade before the Civil War began. As of 2004, more black men were disenfranchised than in 1870, the year the 15th Amendment was ratified, prohibiting laws that explicitly deny the right to vote on the basis of race. Now, of course, during the Jim Crow era, the era of legalized discrimination and segregation in this country. Black folks were kept from the voting booth, from the polls, through poll taxes and literacy tests. Well, today, felon disenfranchisement laws have accomplished in many states what poll taxes and literacy tests ultimately could not. A black child born today has less of a chance of being raised by both parents than a black child born during slavery. This is due in large part to the mass incarceration of black men. There was an interesting article published about this phenomenon in The Economist magazine, of all places, entitled "How the Mass Incarceration of Black Men Harms Black Women." And the article explained that the majority of black women in the United States are unmarried, including 70% of black professional women, and that this is due largely to the mass incarceration of black men, which takes them out of the dating pool at the years they would be most likely to commit to a partner, to a family. But what's worse is that by branding them criminals and felons at very young ages, often before they're even old enough to vote, they are rendered permanently unemployable in the legal job market for the most part, virtually guaranteeing that most will cycle in and out of prison, sometimes for the rest of their lives. 80% of all African American children can now expect to spend at least a significant part of their childhood years living apart from their fathers. And contrary to the image presented in the media of black men being a bunch of deadbeat dads that don't care enough about their children to be involved or to support them, the research actually shows that black men who are separated from their children due to divorce, incarceration, or any other factor are actually more likely to make an effort to maintain meaningful contact and relationships with their children following separation than men of any other racial or ethnic group. But no other racial or ethnic group faces as much separation and forced separation as African Americans. That doesn't mean that black men couldn't do a better job of being fathers, that they couldn't try harder. But so could white men, so could Asian men, so could Latino men, so could mothers, and I speak from experience. We could all do a better job of parenting, but no group faces such extraordinary challenges to playing the role of a traditional father in our society today than black men. And this phenomenon does not affect some small segment of the African American community. To the contrary, in some major urban areas, more than half of working age African American men have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. In fact, in some cities like Baltimore, Chicago, Philadelphia, well, take Chicago, for example. In Chicago, if you take into account prisoners, if you actually count them as people, and of course, prisoners are excluded from poverty statistics and unemployment data, you know, thus masking the severity of racial inequality in the United States. But if you actually count prisoners as people, in the Chicago area, nearly 80% of working age African American men have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. These men are part of a growing undercaste, not class, caste, a group of people defined largely by race, relegated to a permanent second-class status by law. Now, I find that when I tell people that I now believe that mass incarceration is like a new Jim Crow, a new caste system, people react with shocked disbelief. They say, "What are you talking about? Our criminal justice system isn't a system of racial control, it's a system of crime control. And if black folks would just stop running around committing so many crimes, they wouldn't have to worry about being locked up and then stripped of their basic civil and human rights." But therein lies the greatest myth about mass incarceration, namely that it's been driven by crime and crime rates. It's not true. It's not true. It's just not true. During a 30-year period of time, our prison population quintupled, not doubled or tripled, quintupled in a 30-year period of time. Our nation now has the highest rate of incarceration in the world, dwarfing the rates of even highly repressive regimes like Russia or China or Iran. But this is not due to crime rates. During that 30-year period of time, crime rates fluctuated. Went up, went down, went back up again, went back down again. Today, as bad as crime rates are in many parts of the country, crime rates are nationally at historical lows. But incarceration rates have consistently soared. Most criminologists and sociologists today will acknowledge that crime rates and incarceration rates in the United States have moved independently of one another. Incarceration rates, especially black incarceration rates, have soared regardless of whether crime was going up or down in any given community or the nation as a whole. So what explains this sudden explosion in incarceration, black incarceration, if not crime or crime rates? No, not entirely. Well, that is definitely a piece of the puzzle. Yes, there was a drastic shift in attitudes. There was a wave of punitiveness that washed over the United States. We declared a war on drugs, and a get tough movement was born on the heels of the civil rights movement. The war on drugs and the get tough movement is responsible for the quintupling of our prison population in a few short decades. What has changed dramatically is not crime, but what counts as crime and how we respond to it. And nothing has contributed more to the emergence of this new caste system than the war on drugs. Drug convictions alone, just drug convictions, accounted for about 2/3 of the increase in the federal prison system and more than half of the increase in the state system between 1985 and 2000, the period of our prison system's most dramatic expansion. Drug convictions have increased more than 1,000% since the drug war began. I mean, to get a sense of how large a contribution the drug war has made to mass incarceration, consider this. There are more people in prisons and jails today just for drug offenses than were incarcerated for all reasons in 1980. Now, most Americans violate drug laws in their lifetime. Most do. That's a fact. But the drug war, not by accident, has been waged almost exclusively in poor communities of color, even though studies have consistently shown now for decades, that contrary to popular belief, people of color are not any more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites, or sell. Now, that defies our basic racial stereotypes about who a drug dealer is. You know, most Americans, they're honest with themselves. When asked to picture a drug dealer, we'll picture some black kid standing on a street corner with his pants sagging down. And plenty of drug dealing happens in the hood, but it happens everywhere else in America as well. A white kid living in rural South Dakota does not drive to the hood to get his marijuana or his meth or his cocaine. No, he gets it most likely from someone of his own race down the road. Drug markets, much like American society generally, are fairly segregated by race. Black folks tend to sell black folks, whites to whites, even segregated by class. University students sell to each other. Drug dealing happens in all communities of all colors, but those who do time for drug crime are overwhelmingly black and brown. In some states, 80 to 90% of all drug offenders sent to prison have been one race, African American. Now, I find that many people, when they see the data, they say, oh, that's a shame. That's too bad, but you know what? We need a drug war in those communities because that's where the violent offenders are. That's where the drug kingpins can be found. We need to get tough in those communities because that's where the violent offenders can be found. In fact, in my experience, most people seem to imagine that the war on drugs was declared in response to the emergence of crack cocaine in inner city communities and the related violence. And for quite a while, I believed that as well. But that is not true. President Ronald Reagan declared the current drug war in 1982 at a time when drug crime was actually on the decline, not on the rise. President Richard Nixon was the first to coin the term a war on drugs, but it was President Ronald Reagan who turned that rhetorical war into a literal one. And at the time he declared his drug war, drug crime was actually on the decline, not on the rise, and less than 3% of the American population identified drugs as among the nation's most pressing concerns. So why declare a national drug war at a time when drug crime is declining, not rising, and the American population doesn't seem much concerned about it? Well, from the outset, the war on drugs had relatively little to do with genuine concern about drug addiction or drug abuse, and nearly everything to do with politics, racial politics. Numerous historians and political scientists have now documented that the war on drugs was part of a grand Republican Party strategy known as the Southern Strategy, of using racially coded get tough appeals on issues of crime and welfare to appeal to poor and working class whites, particularly in the South, who were anxious about, fearful of, resentful of many of the gains of African Americans in the civil rights movement. Now, to be fair, I think we have to acknowledge that poor and working class whites really had their world rocked by the civil rights movement. I mean, wealthy whites could send their kids to private schools and give their kids all of the advantages that wealth has to offer. But poor and working class whites who themselves were struggling for survival, they faced a social demotion in the civil rights movement. It was their kids who might be bused across town to a school they believed was inferior. It was their kids and themselves who were suddenly forced to compete on equal terms with this whole new group of people that they've been taught their whole lives to believe were inferior to them for limited jobs and limited opportunities. And to make matters worse from their perspective, affirmative action programs created this impression that black folks were now leapfrogging over them on their way to Harvard, Yale, Stanford, or fancy jobs in corporate America. And this state of affairs created an enormous amount of anger, fear, resentment, anxiety, but it also created an enormous political opportunity. Pollsters and political strategists found that thinly veiled promises to get tough on them, a group not so subtly defined by race, could be enormously successful in persuading poor and working class whites to defect from the Democratic New Deal coalition and join the Republican Party in droves. In the words of H.R. Haldeman, President Richard Nixon's former chief of staff, he explained the strategy this way, quote, "The whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to," end quote. Well, they did. And a couple years after the drug war was announced, crack cocaine hit the streets of inner city communities. And the Reagan administration seized on this development with some glee, actually hiring staff whose job it was to publicize inner city crack babies, crack dealers, the so-called crack whores, and crack-related violence. The wave of media coverage that ensued when crack hit the streets was not the product of just good investigative journalism. It was the result of a media campaign launched by the Reagan administration to bolster public support for a drug war they had already declared and to persuade Congress to devote millions more dollars to waging it. And the plan worked like a charm, almost overnight. Millions more dollars were devoted to the drug war. And once the enemy in this war was racially defined, a wave of punitiveness swept the United States. Congress and state legislatures nationwide began to compete with one another to pass ever harsher drug laws, harsh mandatory minimum sentences. You'd have small-time drug offenders receiving sentences harsher than murderers receive in other Western democracies. And almost immediately, Democrats began competing with Republicans to prove they could be even tougher on them than their Republican counterparts. And so it was President Bill Clinton who escalated the drug war far beyond what his Republican predecessors even dreamed possible. It was the Clinton administration that championed the laws denying drug offenders even federal financial aid for schooling upon release. It was the Clinton administration that championed laws banning drug offenders from public housing. And it was the Clinton administration that championed the federal law banning drug offenders even from food stamps for the rest of their lives. Many of the laws that now constitute the basic architecture of this new caste system were championed by a Democratic administration desperate to win back those so-called white swing voters, the Reagan Democrats, the folks who had defected from the Democratic Party in the wake of the Civil Rights Movement. Now, in my experience, even many people who are familiar with this history will defend the drug war nonetheless. They'll say, we need a drug war, because what about all those violent offenders and drug kingpins in the hood? But what many people don't realize is that this drug war has never been focused on rooting out the violent offenders or the drug kingpins. Federal funding has flowed to those state and local law enforcement agencies that boost the sheer numbers of drug arrests. It's been a numbers game. What has been rewarded in this war is the sheer volume of drug arrests. Millions of dollars in federal grant money is provided to state and local law enforcement agencies based on the number of people swept into the system for drug offenses, virtually guaranteeing that law enforcement will go out looking for the so-called low-hanging fruit, stopping, frisking, searching as many people as possible in an effort to boost their numbers and continue to qualify for that financial aid. And to make matters worse, federal drug forfeiture laws allow state and local law enforcement agencies to keep, for their own use, up to 80% of the cars, cash, homes seized from suspected drug offenders. You don't have to be convicted. If you are just suspected of a drug offense, law enforcement can take your car, your cash, seize your property. Well, the results are predictable. People of color have been rounded up en masse for relatively minor, nonviolent drug offenses. In 2005, for example, 4 out of 5 drug offenses, simple possession. Only 1 out of 5 for sales. Most people in state prison for drug offenses have no history of violence or even significant selling activity. And in fact, in the 1990s, the Clinton years, the period of the most dramatic expansion of the drug war, nearly 80% of the increase in drug arrests were for marijuana possession, a drug that has now been shown to be less harmful, less addictive than alcohol or tobacco, and at least, if not more prevalent, in middle-class white communities and on college campuses as it is in the hood. But by waging this drug war almost exclusively in the hood, we've managed to create this vast new racial undercast in an astonishingly short period of time. But of course, being swept into the system is only the beginning. Because once you've been swept in and branded a criminal or a felon, even if you get just felony probation, like the young man in my office, for the rest of your life, you will be punished. You will have to check the box on employment applications for the rest of your life. Doesn't matter if the crime you committed happened 4 weeks ago, 4 years ago, or 45 years ago. For the rest of your life, you've got to check that box asking the dreaded question, have you ever been convicted of a felony? Hundreds of professional licenses are off limits to people convicted of felonies. In fact, in my state, in Ohio, you can't even get a license to be a barber if you've been convicted of a felony. People often say to me, oh, come on. You know, they could get a job if they try. I mean, if they really try, if they really apply themselves. So many people, those don't even want to work. They could get a job if they try. Say, really? Try getting a job at McDonald's with a felony record. Housing discrimination is perfectly legal. Employment discrimination legal. Housing discrimination legal. Public housing projects, private landlords free to discriminate against you for the rest of your life. You can be denied housing, access to public housing for a crime you committed 30 years ago. in your youth? Where are you supposed to sleep? Food stamps, public benefits can be off limits to you, financial aid for schooling, if you want to improve yourself, get an education, off limits. What are folks expected to do? Imagine you're just released from prison, you can't get a job, barred from housing, even food stamps are off limits to you. What are you expected to do? Well, apparently what we expect them to do is to pay hundreds or thousands of dollars in fees, fines, court costs, accumulated back child support, which continues to accrue while you're in prison. And in a growing number of states, you're actually expected to pay back the costs of your imprisonment. And all of this can be a condition of your probation or parole. And then get this, if you're one of the lucky few who actually manages to get a job out of prison, you actually get that job, up to 100% of your wages can be garnished, up to 100%, to pay back all those fees, fines, court costs, accumulated back child support. What are folks expected to do? Say, what does this system seem designed to do? It seems designed to send folks right back to prison, which is what in fact happens the vast majority of the time. About 75% of people released from prison return within 3 years, and the majority of those who return in some states do so in a matter of months because the challenges associated with mere survival on the outside are so immense. But as bad as all the formal barriers to political and economic inclusion are, many people who have been labeled criminals have told me that that's not even the worst of it. It's not even the worst of it. It's the stigma that follows you for the rest of your life. That's the hardest to bear. It's not just the denial of the job, but the look that crosses an employer's face when he sees, oh, that box has been checked. It's not just the denial of housing, but the shame of having to beg your grandma to sleep in her basement at night because nowhere else will take you in. It's the shame associated with being branded that causes so many people who have been branded criminals or felons to try to pass. You know, during the Jim Crow era, light-skinned blacks would try to pass as white to avoid the shame and stigma associated with race. Well, today, people labeled criminals try to pass, not just by lying to employers, by failing to check the box or on employment applications or housing forms, but by lying, denying, avoiding friends, family members, loved ones. There was an excellent ethnographic study conducted in Washington, D.C. by an ethnographer who's now a Georgetown law professor. It was a study conducted in neighborhoods hardest hit by mass incarceration in Washington, D.C., and these are neighborhoods where literally every young black man expects to serve time in prison. It is difficult to find anyone who has never gone to jail. And you would think in these communities that imprisonment would be so normal that everyone would just be talking about it all the time, who's in, who's out. And to a certain extent that was true. But what they found in this study was that they were unable to find even one person, who had fully come out to their friends, neighbors, loved ones about their own criminal history or that of their loved ones. Children, when asked by a relative, honey, where's your daddy? I haven't seen your daddy in a long time. Where's your daddy at? Where's your daddy? What's he up to? My daddy, I don't know where my daddy is. Knowing full well their father's in prison. People released from prison, bumping into friends on the street, haven't seen in a while, asked, hey, I haven't seen you. It must have been years. Where have you been? How are you doing? What have you been up to? Oh, you know, I've been out of town. I've been here, there. I'll talk to you later. The shame creates an eerie silence, even in the communities hardest hit by mass incarceration. And this silence makes collective political action nearly impossible. So what do we do? Where do we go from here? Well, I think one thing that has become clear is that those of us in the civil rights community, We've allowed a human rights nightmare to occur on our watch. We've been sleeping through a revolution. While many of us have been fighting to hold on to affirmative action or the perceived gains of the civil rights movement, millions of people have been rounded up, locked in cages, and then released into a parallel social universe in which they're denied the very rights that some of our parents or even grandparents fought for and some died for. As a nation, we have now spent $1 trillion waging this drug war since it began. Funds that could have been used for schools, for economic investment in the poorest communities. $1 trillion could have been used to promote our collective well-being. Instead, those dollars paved the way for the destruction of countless lives, families, and dreams. So what do? Where do we go from here? Well, my own view is that nothing short of a major social movement has any hope of ending mass incarceration in America. And if you imagine that something less, surely something less, will do, consider this. If we were to return to the rates of incarceration we had in the 1970s, before the war on drugs and the Get Tough movement gained steam, we would have to release 4 out of 5 people who are in prison today. 4 out of 5. More than 1 million people employed by the criminal justice system would lose their jobs. Most new prison construction has occurred in predominantly white rural communities, and many of these communities have been led to believe that prisons are the answer to their economic woes. Those prisons across America would have to close. Private prison companies listed on the New York Stock Exchange would be forced to watch their profits vanish. This system is now so deeply rooted in our social, political, and economic structure that it's not going to just fade away. It's not going to just downsize out of sight without a major upheaval, a fairly radical shift in our public consciousness. Now, I know that there's many people who say there is really no hope of ending mass incarceration in America. Just as many people resign to Jim Crow in the South and shake their heads and say, yeah, it's a shame, but that's just the way that it is. Today, many people view the millions cycling in and out of our nations and jails as just an unfortunate but inalterable fact of American life. Well, I am confident that Dr. King, Ella Baker, Sojourner Truth, and the many other freedom fighters who came before us would not be so easily deterred. So it's time for us to take the baton. We have got to be willing to continue the work. We have got to be willing to go back where they left off and do the hard work of movement building on behalf of poor people of all colors. In 1968, Dr. King told advocates that the time had come to shift from a civil rights movement to a human rights movement. Meaningful equality, he said, could not be achieved through civil rights alone. Without basic human rights, the right to work, the right to housing, the right to quality education. Without basic human rights, he said, civil rights are an empty promise. So in honor of Dr. King and all those people of all colors who labored to end the old Jim Crow, I hope we will build a human rights movement to end mass incarceration, a movement for education, not incarceration, a movement for jobs, not jails, a movement to end all these forms of legal discrimination that deny people their basic human rights to work, to shelter, and to food. Now, what must we do to build this movement? Well, first, we've got to be willing to start telling the truth. The whole truth. We've got to be willing to admit out loud that we as a nation have managed to recreate a caste-like system in this country. And we've got to be willing to tell this truth in our schools, in our community centers, in our places of worship. We have got to be willing to tell this truth so that a great awakening can begin. But of course, a lot of talk isn't going to be enough. We also have to be willing to build an underground railroad for the people returning home from prison. We have got to be willing to extend much needed help, support, jobs, housing, food, open arms, love to people returning home from prison and support for their families who are dealing and struggling, coping with the grief of having a loved one behind bars. We have got to be willing to support with open arms all those who are willing to make a genuine break for freedom. But we've got to be willing to create safe spaces for people. Create safe places for people to admit their criminality out loud. Places where people don't feel ashamed. And how do we create those safe places? Well, I think one thing we've got to do is to begin to admit our own criminality out loud. Our own criminality. Many people say to me, "What are you talking about? I'm not a criminal. I'm not a criminal." I say, "Okay. Well, maybe you never drank underage. Maybe you never experimented with drugs. Well, if the worst thing you've ever done in your unadventurous life is speed 10 miles over the speed limit on the freeway, you've put yourself and others at more risk of harm than someone smoking marijuana in the privacy of their living room." But there are... That's the truth. But there are people doing life sentences for first-time drug offenses in the United States. Life sentences. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld life sentences for first-time drug offenses against an Eighth Amendment challenge that such a sentence was cruel and unusual punishment. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, no, it's not cruel and unusual to sentence a young man on a first-time drug offense to life imprisonment, even though virtually no other country in the world does such a thing. So rather than imagining that the criminals are them, not us, I think we've got to be willing to say, "There but for the grace of God go I." After all, President Barack Obama himself, President Obama himself is admitted to using more than a little bit of drugs in his lifetime. In his youth, he used marijuana, used cocaine. And if he had not been raised by a white mother in Kansas or white grandparents in Hawaii, if he had been raised in the hood, the odds are great that he would have been stopped, he would have been searched, he would have been frisked, he would have been caught. And far from being president of the United States today, he might not even have the right to vote. So this is about all of us. It's about recognizing and honoring the dignity of all of us. But just helping a few and creating safe places for a few and telling the truth, even that is not enough. Because just as during the days of slavery, it wasn't enough to build the Underground Railroad, you had to be willing to work for abolition. Today, we have got to be willing to work for the abolition of this system of mass incarceration. Abolish it entirely. And that means ending the drug war once and for all. It means ending all these forms of legal discrimination against people released from prison that keep them locked in a permanent second status for life. And it means shifting from a purely punitive approach to dealing with violence and violent crime to a more restorative and rehabilitative approach, one that takes seriously the interests of the victim, the offender, and the community as a whole. So we've got a lot of work to do. We've got a lot of work to do, and if you think like it sounds like too much, if you think we can't possibly rise to the challenge that's before us, keep in mind that all of the rules, laws, policies, and practices that comprise this system of mass incarceration rest upon one core belief, and it is the same core belief that sustained Jim Crow. It's the belief that some of us, are not worthy of genuine care, compassion, and concern. And when we effectively challenge that core belief, this whole system begins to fall like dominoes. A multiracial, multiethnic human rights movement must be born, one that takes seriously the dignity and humanity of all people. And yes, it has got to be multiracial and multiethnic. I mean, this drug war may have been born with black folks in mind, But it is a war that has destroyed the lives of people in communities of all colors. A young white kid who's getting a prison sentence, rather than the drug treatment he desperately needs but cannot afford, is suffering because of a drug war declared with black folks in mind. And we now see that another war has been declared, a war on illegal immigrants that is leading to another prison building boom. So we have got to be willing to connect the dots and build a multiracial, multi-ethnic movement on behalf of all of us. But before this movement can truly get underway, a great awakening is required. We have got to awaken from this colorblind slumber that we've been in to the realities of race in America. And we've got to be willing to embrace those labeled criminals. Not necessarily all their behavior, but them, their humanness. For it has been the refusal and failure to recognize the dignity and humanity of all people that has been the sturdy foundation for every caste system that has ever existed in the United States or anywhere else in the world. It's our task, I firmly believe, to end not just mass incarceration, not just the war on drugs, but to end this history and cycle of caste in America. Thank you so much for having me tonight. Thank you. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Michelle, for that incredible talk. We have about a half hour to solve this problem, so we should get started. You covered a lot of ground, obviously, but I wanted to start just by sort of noting this moment we're in politically, and we're coming off of these conventions, right, that have sort of completely taken over, at least in the field that I work. Just everyone's attention is just on what people are saying, what gaffes is Joe Biden committing, what did Clinton say, and there's almost like this amnesia about when, especially all this kind of Clinton nostalgia and worship, and Biden, who had such an instrumental role mm-hmm. in the laws that you describe and the escalation of the drug war. So I wanted to ask, to start by asking you, how do we begin to remind people of this history when people seem so eager to forget it? And also, new generations who barely remember the Clinton administration somehow seem to have inherited this sense of a sort of lovable Bubba and crazy Uncle Joe.
So. Yes, yes. Well, you know, it's a voluntary amnesia. You know, we prefer to remember the good times about the Clinton administration, and there were some. But what's interesting, actually, and Bruce Western, who published a great book called Punishment and Inequality, Bruce Western has done an enormous amount of research about kind of the economic status of black men. And one of the things that he found in his research was that black men were actually the only demographic group during the Clinton years who actually saw their fortunes fall rather than rise. Their joblessness increased, their income levels decreased quite dramatically, and that this was due entirely to the skyrocketing rates of incarceration during that period. And so, although Clinton is actually quite beloved within the black community, I mean, many refer to him as the first black president, you know, and so after he got on, what was it, David Letterman played a saxophone, you know, he was the first black president, and yet he was, you know, he was responsible for ratcheting up the drug war that has had such a devastating impact on black families and communities, and champion the very laws that now keep people really locked in a second-class status. And, you know, there aren't very many opportunities to tell this truth in the mainstream media. And so one of the things that I find encouraging is that there is a growing willingness among young people to use YouTube and the internet and blogging and all of this online media as a way of telling truths that aren't readily accepted or, you know, told in the mainstream media. And I hope we will see more of that. On a more discouraging note, you know, in my travels and talking to a lot of different communities about these issues, I have found that many young people will say to me, "What's Jim Crow?" And so it's not just amnesia about the Clinton administration. there is some serious amnesia about our racial history that Black History Month hasn't apparently cured. And so, you know, I think that's actually a place where we have to begin, is helping people understand the relationship of our racial history and those politics to our present.
So coming off of that, you wrote your book while Barack Obama was running for president, is that correct?
Yes.
And so as you wrote your book, I think you've described how you thought to yourself, oh man, if it's going to be difficult to convince people that this racial caste system exists, how much harder will it be if we elect the first Black president? And this is what's come to pass. And yet, in your book, you argue very convincingly that in fact the maintenance of this caste system relies on stories of Black success, which are epitomized by the election of Barack Obama. So how did that shape the way you made your argument in the end, and how has it been received?
Well, it's interesting because I actually thought that a lot of people would want to talk to me about the critique I make of affirmative action towards the end of the book, but very few people have. So I'm glad you have asked me about it. You know, towards the end of the book, I talk about how important Black exceptionalism is to the maintenance of this caste system. That as long as it's possible to point to Black people who seem to be doing well, it's easy to blame those who aren't making it and say, well, if you just worked harder like Barack Obama, then you could be president too. When the reality is if Barack Obama had been born into the caste system, he wouldn't be president. He may not even be able to vote. And it was because of the privilege that he had access to, which really was white privilege, the privilege of being able to attend predominantly white universities, the privilege of not being raised in a community defined by race and class, that made it possible for him to avoid this caste-like system. And, you know, one of the downsides of affirmative action is that it has created cosmetic diversity. It has sprinkled people of color through elite institutions and halls of power, creating this illusion of great racial progress when the structural conditions on the ground in so many communities are as bad and in some places worse than they were, 50 years ago. And so in this way, affirmative action has masked the severity of racial inequality that exists in the United States. And I fear that, you know, many advocates, you know, like myself, have been tempted to really trade away work on the harder fights, the movement building on behalf of poor people, for what amounts to more cosmetic reforms that allow, you know, a relatively small group of people to get access to, you know, education and political power, really on a trickle-down theory that, you know, if people of color reach the top, equality will trickle down. And, you know, I think we can see from experience it hasn't quite turned out that way.
Along the same lines, you call for a mass movement, a grassroots movement, to end mass incarceration. And since your book was published, you know, the closest we've come to seeing any kind of grassroots uprising on a national level was the Occupy movement, right? Mm-hmm. Which had just these kind of organic pockets that sprung up. And I remember in New York when it started, and it sort of seemed like this nothing little thing that no one was paying attention to, and then all of a sudden, it was receiving national news coverage. And I know in New York there were efforts, there were kind of working groups, there were groups within groups that were very interested in talking about prisons, which was new to me because I had done I've done organizing in New York around the death penalty, around prisons. And I wonder, obviously Occupy hasn't lasted in that form, but I wonder what your take is on that, and particularly what it shows us about the difficulty of organizing a multiracial movement, which was a real problem, I think, for a lot of organizers.
Yeah, you know, I was really thrilled to see the Occupy movement emerge, and, you know, there was a lot of criticism early on about the Occupy movement being overwhelmingly white and somewhat disconnected from the experiences and concerns of poor communities of color. But, you know, Occupy movement in Oakland turned out to be one of the longest lasting, most vital, manifestations of Occupy. And they were taking up kind of issues related to criminal justice reform in prisons and all of that, which was really encouraging. I think a lot of work has to be done at the grassroots level, defining goals of what the movement is. I mean, you know, everyone loved the Occupy movement precisely because it didn't have a well-defined agenda. So you could figure out where you fit in. But at some point, you know, you have to be able to define precisely what it is that you want to achieve through your movement in order to really gain traction over the long haul. And, you know, with the civil rights movement, you know, the goal initially was defined as ending the legal regime known as Jim Crow. But what they found is once they ended that legal regime, the system could still function quite well because the attitudes had been so ingrained and the institutions, were so saturated with long-standing bias, and the disadvantages that groups, had accrued over time were so severe that it was going to take far more than simply dismantling the legal system in order to undo the caste system. So today, it's really my hope that advocates will come together and really do what King was talking about at the end of his life. You know, at the end of his life, he was building a poor people's movement. He had moved on from the civil rights movement and was building a poor people's movement, organizing people across racial and ethnic lines for economic justice and demanding a right to work, a right to housing, a right to quality education. I think that many folks have not yet coalesced around a human rights framework and been willing to say, sometimes out of fear of being called socialist, that we should, you know, have a right to work, a right to quality education, a right to housing, that these aren't privileges that have to be earned either by good behavior or, you know, your own connections, but actually as a human being and as a society, we ought to organize ourselves in such a way that we can, you know, put everyone to work and provide housing and education for all of us.
I want to ask you about a couple of sort of forms of dissent that almost come down to an individual, that put incredible demands on individuals, but that could be potentially a part of this kind of movement. And you wrote an op-ed for the New York Times in March that really made a splash, at least among people I knew, and it was called Go to Trial, Crash the System. And it was about what would happen if defendants were to stop plea bargaining and go to trial, because something like 90% of these cases never do go to trial. People just plead guilty. And you wrote, and this was so stunning to me, quote, "The system of mass incarceration depends almost entirely on the cooperation of those it seeks to control. If everyone charged with crime suddenly exercised his constitutional rights, there would not be enough judges, lawyers, or prison cells to deal with the ensuing tsunami of litigation." I mean, that's powerful.
Yeah, it's true.
Now, actually doing that would expose people to great risks because it would mean facing long sentences. And I wonder what the response to that, because it's a very compelling argument, but was it more of a thought experiment? What would it take to follow that through to its logical conclusion?
Yeah, well, I should say, you know, the idea was not mine. It was actually Susan Burton, who is a phenomenal advocate in Los Angeles. I'm glad to hear some of you know of her. She is a phenomenal advocate in Los Angeles. She herself is formerly incarcerated. She cycled in and out of prison for 15 years due to a drug addiction after the LAPD ran over her 5-year-old son in the street. And you know, if she had been wealthy or, you know, if she had a good health care plan, she would have qualified for many, many hours of counseling and access to legal drugs to help her cope with her grief. But because she was poor and did not have access to those resources, she wound herself, in the wake of her son's death, addicted to crack cocaine, cycled in and out of prison for 15 years, tossed on the street, unable to find work or housing. Finally, when she became clean, she decided she wanted to devote the rest of her life ensuring that no other woman would have to suffer what she went through. And not only does she now run 5 safe homes for women in Los Angeles, women returning home from prison, providing them with support and finding employment and housing and reunifying with their children, but she's also organizing, helping to organize formerly incarcerated people for the restoration of their basic civil and human rights, in conjunction with an organization called All of Us or None. And Susan called me one day and said, basically, look, you know, I have this idea. We've been talking about the fact that if all of us just refuse to plea, we can crash the system. And I said, you're right. You're right. You know, the reality is that trials happen on TV, on Law and Order, but they don't happen much in real life. You know, more than 95% of all cases plea out. And in the federal system, I think it's like 98% of all cases plea out. Almost no one goes to trial. And this isn't because everyone's so eager to relieve their conscience by, you know, confessing and pleading to crimes. It's because the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that it is perfectly constitutional. It does not deny you your Sixth Amendment right to trial to threaten you with much greater punishment, even life imprisonment, for taking your case to trial. And so, you know, that Supreme Court case actually involved a man who, I believe, had been arrested for passing about $68 in bad checks. And he wanted to take his case to trial. The prosecutor told him, if you take your case to trial, we're going to seek life imprisonment. And he took his case to trial and lost. And he is serving life in prison for $68 in bad checks. So when the prosecutor tells you, as a first-time drug offender or whatever crime you've been committed, if you don't take this plea and you dare take this case to trial, you're going to do, you know, a decade, 2 decades, even life imprisonment, they're not bluffing. So most rational people take the plea. And Susan's idea is really radical because she recognizes that if all of these millions of people who are charged with crimes say, I'm not taking the plea, I'm exercising my Sixth Amendment right to trial, the whole system would crash practically overnight. There'd just be no way to deal with the tsunami of litigation. But it would also mean that some people would end up serving life in prison for crimes they might have gotten probation for. And, you know, being willing to take that kind of risk and that kind of sacrifice, I think, is, you know, more than I feel comfortable asking people. But as Susan said, well, maybe, just maybe, some of us are going to have to risk our lives to bring this system to an end.
I want to ask you about the Supreme Court, but first I have a question about another form of dissent, which I don't know that you cover in your book, which is also pretty interesting, and that's jury nullification, this concept of jury nullification. And this, there is a former federal prosecutor named Paul Butler who wrote a book for the New Press also, who's endorsed this idea. And it's basically the concept is that as a juror, you refuse to convict a person who's even technically guilty on for a crime that you consider to be unjust, basically. Tell me if that's correct. So what's your take on jury nullification? And people who I've mentioned it to seem very interested.
Well, I have mixed feelings about jury nullification. On the one hand, I would have no problem nullifying a jury, although no one will ever let me on a criminal jury again. But I would have, you know, Paul Butler. You know, just as a little bit of background, Paul Butler is a former federal prosecutor who had his epiphany after he was arrested for a crime he didn't commit while he was a prosecutor. He was arrested for a crime he did not commit and saw how the criminal justice machinery was now moving against him. And he saw police officers take the stand and lie. And he realized that the only hope that he had for getting off was not his innocence, was the fact that he could afford to hire the best attorney in the city. And that is what made the difference for him, not his actual innocence. And that led him to become one of the most fierce critics of our criminal. He's no longer a prosecutor, as you might imagine. And so one of his arguments, you know, is what you describe, but he limits it to nonviolent drug offenses. He says, you know, if you get called for jury duty and someone is being charged with a nonviolent drug offense, possession, just acquit, period. Don't, you know, matter what the evidence is. I think I would be happy to do it. It's actually perfectly within your rights. It's not illegal for you to nullify a jury. I think as a strategy for challenging the system as a whole, I much prefer tainting the jury pool. So I would show up, you know, when it's time for, you know, to be called for jury and asked, is there any reason why you might not be able to be fair and impartial, to raise my hand and say in front of everyone, I don't think I can, you know, impartially judge this, knowing as I do how police target black men, in particular in the war on drugs, and the devastation this drug war has caused. I mean, that would taint the jury pool in a way where it would force them to continue to have to reconvene juries, and it would force the system to have to respond in a way that I think might be more impactful and actually be more newsworthy than, you know, individual jury applications.
So speaking of a different part of the legal system, one of the most devastating parts of your book is the section in which you describe how the Supreme Court for decades now has taken extraordinary steps to immunize the criminal justice system from sort of having to answer to racial discrimination, to clear racial discrimination in outcomes and sentencing and all fronts. And I was hoping that you might be able to describe a little bit of that, since you didn't get to it in your talk. And also, to what extent is that even reversible if there are new appointments to the bench?
Yeah. Well, I guess it depends on who those appointments are. But you know, people often say to me, you know, why not just file a big class action suit to stop this system? And what people don't realize is the U.S. Supreme Court has now closed the courthouse doors to claims of racial bias at every stage of the criminal justice process, from stops and searches to plea bargaining and sentencing. It is now virtually impossible to file a lawsuit today alleging race discrimination in the criminal justice system without evidence of conscious, intentional bias on the part of a law enforcement official, tantamount to an admission by a law enforcement official that, yeah, I'm giving you life sentence because you're black. Now, of course, most law enforcement officials, like the rest of us, don't admit our racial biases out loud. But more importantly, so many of the biases that drive law enforcement decision-making operate in such an unconscious level that many well-meaning, well-intentioned officers can't even admit to themselves their own biases, much less admit them in a courtroom. But the U.S. Supreme Court has made it impossible to even state a claim for race discrimination in our criminal justice system unless you can offer in advance proof of conscious racial bias on the part of a law enforcement official, which has effectively immunized our, you know, system of mass incarceration from judicial scrutiny for racial bias. And in fact, those racial profiling cases that I was bringing 10, 15 years ago, you can't even bring today. The U.S. Supreme Court has closed the door on pattern and practice racial profiling cases without some kind of smoking gun, you know, by law enforcement saying we're out to get the blacks. And so it's virtually impossible to challenge today. But, you know, in many respects, I kind of view us as in the same position as, you know, we were when Plessy versus Ferguson was on the books, saying separate but equal. It is going to take an enormous amount of work to overturn McCleskey versus Kemp, which is the Supreme Court decision saying that it doesn't matter how much statistical evidence you have of discrimination, it doesn't matter how severe the racial disparities are, unless you have that smoking gun, you can't even state a claim of race discrimination. We are going to have our own Brown v. Board to overturn McCleskey. But I think it's really important also for people to keep in mind that it's not just a matter of the Supreme Court doing the right thing, because Brown versus Board didn't end segregation in the South. Now, 10 years after Brown versus Board of Education was decided, there was almost no desegregation that happened in the South. Brown versus Board accomplished almost nothing in terms of actual desegregation. It took a mass movement to end Jim Crow, and I think we're going to need some kind of comparable upheaval in order to build a public consciousness that would support a radically different direction by the court.
Thank you. Wow, we're almost out of time. We're actually almost out of time, but I wanted to ask one question. I, you know, visit prisons in upstate New York every so often, and I've spoken to so many prisoners, who are not locked up for nonviolent drug crimes, but have actually committed some, you know, very violent crimes, who nonetheless see themselves in your book and have read it cover to cover and talk about it and think about it. One guy who grew up in Brownsville in Brooklyn, you know, one of the poorest sections of the city, said that it really helped him understand, in a way, his own circumstances. And I wonder, because there's, I mean, these are quarters in which there's a real urgency, obviously, to address these questions and to talk them through. And to what extent, what kind of role do you see for prisoners, for guys who are still on the inside, and I'm sure you hear from them a lot, in being a part of this mass movement? And how would you respond to, I guess that would be part of the whole question of creating a broad-based multiracial movement, but what are the challenges? Is that possible?
I think it's absolutely possible. Not only possible, but it's necessary. You know, prisons are out of sight, out of mind. You know, unlike the Jim Crow days where you had whites-only signs in your face and the caste system was right there and undeniable, you know, prisoners are kept often hundreds of miles away, sometimes thousands of miles away from family members, and that separation and isolation is part of what needs to be challenged as we undo this caste system. And I've been so encouraged by not only sort of consciousness-raising efforts within prisons, reading books and forming study circles and all of that within prisons, but also, you know, we've seen the hunger strikes in Alabama and in California, where prisoners are going on hunger strikes to protest solitary confinement and, you know, human rights violations that are happening behind bars. And these efforts, I mean, some of which are, you know, truly historic. I mean, the level of organization and the numbers of people who have participated have received scant coverage, if any, in the mainstream news. But I think it's incumbent upon us to do everything we can to support prisoners who are organizing themselves behind bars and show that we really will be allies, steadfast allies with them, because they often organize themselves at great risk and severe, you know, suffer severe retaliation for their efforts.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I guess that's all the time we've got. Unfortunately, that's all the time we've got, and I know you have a book signing to get to, and you have your next couple of speaking engagements, but thank you so much, Michelle.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.